Okay. Last week we got almost through round two of the debate, lacking chapters 20 and 21. So I want to read Zophar's second reply here, his second speech, which will end round two after Job replies to him. Okay, so Zophar is going to speak, and then Job's going to reply to him, and that's the end of round two. Okay?
Where are you going?
I'm in chapter 20. We're going to read chapter 20.
Do you want me to do the Erdmans?
Yeah, when the time comes.
Yeah. Oh. Well, I need the book.
Okay, so.
It will suffer.
Then Zophar the Naamathite replied, "My troubled thoughts prompt me to answer because I am greatly disturbed. I hear a rebuke that dishonors me, and my understanding inspires me to reply." I love that. You know, it's almost comical, you know. "Surely you know how it has been from old, ever since man was placed on the earth, that the mirth of the wicked is brief. The joy of the godless lasts but a moment. Though his pride reaches to the heavens and his head touches the clouds, he will perish forever like his own dung. Those who have seen him will say, 'Where is he?' Like a dream, he flies away, no more to be found, banished like a vision of the night. The eye that saw him will not see him again. His place will look on him no more. His children must make amends to the poor. His own hands must give back his wealth. The youthful vigor that filled his bones will lie with him in the dust. Though evil is sweet in his mouth and he hides it under his tongue, though he cannot bear to let it go but keeps it in his mouth, still his food will turn sour in his stomach. It will become the venom of serpents within him. He will spit out the riches he swallowed. God will make his stomach vomit them up. He will suck the poison of serpents. The fangs of an adder will kill him. He will not enjoy the streams, the rivers flowing with honey and cream. What he toiled for, he must give back uneaten. He will not enjoy the profit from his trading, for he has oppressed the poor and left them destitute. He has seized houses he did not build. Surely he will have no respite from his craving. He cannot save himself by his treasures. Nothing is left to him to devour. His prosperity will not endure. In the midst of his plenty, distress will overtake him. The full force of misery will come upon him. When he has filled his belly, God will vent his burning anger against him and rain down his blows upon him. Though he flees from an iron weapon, a bronze-tipped arrow pierces him. He pulls it out of his back, the gleaming point out of his liver. Terrors will come over him. Total darkness lies in wait for his treasures. A fire unfanned will consume him and devour what is left in his tent. The heavens will expose his guilt. The earth will rise up against him. The flood will carry off his house, rushing waters on the day of God's wrath. Such is the fate God allots the wicked, the heritage appointed by them for them by God." Wow.
On a dissertation.
You know, I love the humorous introduction here. It's like, He's almost meek, and then he just goes into this tirade about what God's going to do to the wicked. So, from verse 4 here to the end of the chapter, verse 28, this is just a long list of bad things that God does to the wicked people, okay? You notice in verse 23 to 25 there, he talks about raining down blows on him. He flees an iron weapon. That's the same kind of symbology, same kind of hyperbole that Job used when he complained about how God was treating him, you know, he talked about warriors piercing him with arrows and all that. So you'll notice that throughout the debate, Job will say something, and then they'll use it. He'll say, I'm suffering, and they say, well, God makes the wicked suffer. I'm in pain. God brings pain on the wicked. Everything that Job says, not everything, of course, but the things, they turn it right around on Job. So I'm going to let Janice read Erdman here. It's just a little short excerpt. This is Erdman's summary of chapter 20.
Yeah, Zophar's second and last speech. Zophar takes up Bildad's theme, the fate of the wicked. Their prosperity is short-lived, their punishment suffering, certain. We hear no more from him after this. Either he has nothing further to add, or a section of the third round of speeches has been lost. It is possible that chapter 27, 7 through 23, which sounds so strange coming from Job, belongs in fact to Zophar.
Okay, we're going to get to that issue with chapter 27 later today, I hope, but not first next week. But okay, I wrote on the board here. This is, you remember we talked about Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar's theology with the monotonically increasing function of suffering versus sin. This is another way to look at their theology. They put the wicked over here, the righteous over here. The wicked are sometimes referred to as evil, those who don't know God, those who choose a life of sin. The righteous are referred to often as the innocent. They include the orphans and the widows, those who choose to try to live a life of righteousness according to God's word. So, divide the world into two different people. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar says God always punishes. God never blesses the wicked. Okay? The righteous God always blesses, and he never causes pain or grief to the righteous. Okay? And they believe this because they believe God is good, God is just, God is all-powerful, and God is all-knowing. So based on...
That's in the way you can't see those things. Can't see your nice little list. Thank you.
Can everybody see it now?
You're going to have a hard time getting it completely out of the way unless you move it over there.
Well, can everybody see it now?
I can see it. Yeah.
Okay. So, based on God's character, this is what has to be. This is the way things work, according to Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And of course, this is really a very self-consistent and logical theology, isn't it? It's hard to refute this. Except for when you look at the facts, you know. But this is the argument that the atheist uses. They don't separate into wicked and righteous, but they say, God, if you believe in a good, just, all-powerful, all-knowing God, why is there so much suffering in the world? That's their argument. We have a fairly difficult time giving them an answer, don't we? You know?
It's because we think God is like us.
Yeah.
Romans says he's beyond figuring out. So,
yeah.
Just because we don't know the answers, you know?
Yeah.
We're just, who are we?
Yeah, but the atheist says, why would you believe in a God if you can't answer that question? And of course, we know we can't answer that question, but we believe in a God, right? So it comes down to belief. But okay, this is their theology. What's Job say in response to this? You know, and I look back at everything that he said up to this point through chapter 20, and he hasn't really given a systematic, orderly answer to their... They say this, every one of them says this one way or another, from Eliphaz's first speech in chapter 4 through Zophar's speech here, and actually Eliphaz's third speech is coming up, says exactly the same thing again, you know. So Job hasn't really answered yet, but I think we're going to see his answer coming up in the round 3, okay? But Job has been too busy, actually. He's been too busy complaining about what God's done to him. wishing he was dead, defending himself to his three friends. He hasn't really given a systematic answer for why this is not so. Okay?
It is interesting that they accuse him of wickedness, his friends, yet I don't recall any specific accusation. For example, Job, you steal, you don't take care of the poor, okay. Sexual immorality, gossip, lying. There's never any specific examples. Okay.
They have talked about what God does to the wicked and what God does to the innocent without actually... They've not implied, but they've implied that Job is over here because he's suffering.
Right.
But they haven't really gotten down to accusing him of anything yet. But they're going to. They're going to get there. Because they get more and more frustrated with Job because they can't make him see that he is obviously wicked if he's over here. Okay? So, let's see. And I believe he's going to give in chapter 21 and 24... He's going to easily disprove this and this. He's going to refute that, this theology, okay? In chapter 27, he says he disagrees with him about his will, his guilt, and about how God does things, but he agrees with his friends about God's goodness and God's justice. But he feels like God's been unjust to him personally, okay? So, he has to be careful, and if he says this is not so, he's got to be careful he doesn't disprove this, right? If he says God doesn't do this and God doesn't do that, then God must not. He has to be very careful about what he says. Without, he doesn't want to disprove the goodness of God, and so I think he has a hard time with that because he does say this is wrong. Okay, so let's find where I am here. I thought about this. You notice I put this up here deliberately. Always and never. Always and never. Okay? I thought about Janice and I, we were baptized in 1975 at Mayfair, okay? A couple of years after that, maybe we went to a marriage seminar. Y'all remember Burkeen and Faulkner? Some of you remember those? Well, we went to that. One of the things we learned in that was how to have a successful argument with your spouse, how to debate with your spouse, because their position was you're going to have arguments in a marriage. It's very unusual if you don't have arguments. But you need to learn how to argue and debate correctly. And one of the things they said is never, or avoid using always and never. Avoid using always and never.
You never listen to me.
And you never make up the bed, and you never pick up your clothes, and are you always nag me about something? Two reasons I remember from that thing why you don't do that. One is it's real easy to prove you're wrong. It's real. You know, if I say, Janice, you never do this, she said, I did it yesterday. Okay? What's the second reason? Getting ahead of myself here. The second reason is it doesn't help the end of the argument. The argument just gets more heated, right? When you start throwing around never and always. So, Job is going to refute this. Never and always. So, let's read chapter 21. This is Job's reply. And if you want, if I can get two volunteers to read about a half a chapter apiece, can I get that? Judy, if you'll read down through, say, verse 19, and then somebody who will finish the chapter for us. Heard? Okay, I'll get you next. Okay, go ahead.
Job answered and said, keep listening to my words and let this be your comfort. Bear with me and I will speak. And after I have spoken, mock more. As for me, is my complaint against man? Why should I not be impatient? Look at me, be appalled, and lay your hand over your mouth. When I remember, I am dismayed, and shuddering seizes my flesh. Why do the wicked live, reach old age, and grow mighty in power? Their offspring are established in their presence, and their descendants before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear, and no rod of God is upon them. Their bull breeds without fail, their cow calves and does not miscarry. They send out their little boys like a flock, and their children dance. They sing to the tambourine and the lyre, and rejoice to the sound of the pipes. They spend their days in prosperity, and in peace they go down to Sheol. They say to God, depart from us. We do not desire the knowledge of your ways. What is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what profit do we get if we pray to him? Behold, is not their prosperity in their hand? The counsel of the wicked is far from me. Through 19?
Yeah.
How often is it that the lamp of the wicked is put out, that their calamity comes upon them, that God distributes pains in his anger? They are like straw before the wind and like chaff that the storm carries away. You say, God stores up their iniquity for their children. Let him pay it out to them that they may know it.
Let their own eyes see their destruction. Let them drink the cup of wrath of the Almighty. For what do they care about the families they leave behind when they allotted months come to an end? Yet anyone teach knowledge to God? Since the judges, even the highest one, one person dies in full vigor, completely secure and at ease, well nourished in body, bones rich with marrow. Another dies in bitterness of soul, never having enjoyed anything good. Side by side they lie in the dust, and worms cover them both. I know full well what you are thinking, the schemes by which you would wrong me. You say, where now is the house of the great, the tents where the wicked live? Have you never questioned those who travel? Have you paid no regard to their accounts, that the wicked are spared from the day of calamity, that they are delivered from the day of wrath? Who denounces their conduct to their face? Who repays them for what they have done? They are carried to the grave, and watch is kept over their tombs. The soil in the valley is sweet to them. Everyone follows after them, and a countless throng goes before them. So how can you console me with your nonsense? Nothing is left to your answer but falsehood.
Okay, so he's obviously lost respect for his friends, and he's just mock on, you know, just listen. But then he says, and he says this terrifies him. He's terrified when he thinks about it, but God doesn't always punish the wicked. Sometimes they prosper. Sometimes they have happy families. They accumulate wealth. They live their life without suffering, and then they die at peace, you know. God doesn't do this at all. Okay, so.
And all the time they're saying, we don't need that. What good would you do to pray?
We don't need God.
And you know, if you live very long, you've heard people say that.
Yeah. I think verse 16 is the key. He says, and this is the NIV version, but their prosperity is not in their own hands. In other words, their prosperity is in the hands of God. But God, and so God is leaving them prosperous even though they're wicked, okay? So he says, I stand aloof from the counsel of the wicked. So Job is still clinging to his integrity. He is clinging to his desire to live a righteous life, even though he doesn't see any advantage. The wicked are in the same boat he is. They either prosper or they don't. That's what he says down in 23 through 26. That everybody, wicked and innocent, they
Some die young, after suffering a lot. Some die after old age. He doesn't see that God makes any distinction at all. So he asked in 17 and 18, how often does God destroy the wicked? In 19 he says, you know, what he's saying in 19 and following there is, this theology says, well, maybe God is saving up their punishment for their children. He said, Job says, no, let them get their own punishment. Don't save it for the children, you know. So I feel like he has refuted this very strongly in chapter 21. Okay? It says in verse 30 and 31, the wicked man is not always, he's not denounced to his face. Nobody calls him to account for what he's done. He goes to the grave in peace. Okay? So, read Erdman 21. Okay. This is what Erdman says about it.
So far, theology is all very well, but it flies in the face of experience. The condition of Job, the good man, is pitiful. Verse 5. Yet, more often than not, evil men flourish, live happily, and die peacefully. In verses 7 and 18. The friends will argue that God's vengeance falls on their children. In verse 19. Well, what kind of justice is that? Their so-called comfort is nothing but a pack of empty lies. Job calls it nonsense.
Yeah, nonsense and falsehood. Okay.
It said it looks like Job's punishment fell on his kids.
Yeah.
They were all killed.
That's what EBZ said. He said they say that several times. They bring up his kids to him, which has got to be painful for him. You know, in one place they said they got what they deserved.
But now they're saying they got what Job deserved.
Right. Yeah.
So why is Job getting it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's backwards, isn't it?
Right.
With friends like that, you don't need no enemy.
That's right.
What do you say?
Yeah.
With friends like that, you don't need any enemies.
Yeah, I think it is ironic that they come to comfort and console their friend, Job, and they get more and more adamant that he's a wicked, wicked person, you know. They become a torment to him in addition to his suffering. So that's one of the life lessons I want us to learn from this book is be real careful how you comfort people that are struggling and suffering, okay? Because sometimes you can say things that hurt them more than, you know, sometimes your silence is the best thing. Your presence and your silence is the best thing for a suffering person. Okay, Eliphaz is going to reply in chapter 22, and he says exactly the same thing that they've been saying since the beginning. Then Bildad is going to reply in chapter 25, and it's just a short little six verses. So he doesn't really, he's given up. And then as Janice noted in Erdman's, Zophar doesn't speak at all in the third round of the debate here. And there's some problem there we'll talk about when we get there. But let's read Eliphaz's third reply here. This is the beginning of round three of the debate. Okay? Somebody, let's see how long it is. Can somebody read that chapter? It's just about one page.
I'll read it.
Okay.
Then Eliphaz the Temanite.
Read louder. Speak up.
Then Eliphaz the Temanite replied, "Can a man be of benefit to God? Can even a wise person benefit him? What pleasure would it give the Almighty if you were righteous? What would he gain if your ways were blameless? Is it for your
piety
that he rebukes you and brings charges against you? Is not your wickedness great? Are not your sins endless? You demand security from your relatives for no reason. You strip people of their clothing, leaving them naked. You gave no water to the weary, and you withheld food from the hungry. Though you were a powerful man owning land, an honored man living on it, and you sent widows away empty-handed, and broke the strength of the fatherless. That is why snares are all around you, why sudden peril terrifies you, why it is so dark you cannot see, and why a flood of water covers you. Is not God in the heights of heaven? And see how lofty you are the highest stars. Yet you say, what does God know? Does he judge through such darkness that clouds veil him, so he does not see us? As he goes about in the vaulted heavens, will you keep to the old path that the wicked have trod? They were carried off before their time, their foundations washed away by a flood. They said to God, leave us alone. What can the Almighty do to us? Yet it was he who filled their houses with good things. So I stand aloof from the plans of the wicked. The righteous see their ruin and rejoice. The innocent mock them, saying, surely our foes are destroyed, and fire devours their wealth. Submit to God and be at peace with him, and this way prosperity will come to you. Accept instruction from his mouth and lay up his words in your heart. If you return to the Almighty, you will be restored. If you remove wickedness far from your tent and assign your nuggets to the dust, your gold of Ophir to the rocks and in the ravines, when the Almighty will be your gold, the choicest silver for you, surely then you will find delight in the Almighty. You will lift up your face to God, you will pray to him and he will hear you, and you will fulfill your vows. What you decide on will be done, and light will shine on your ways. When people are brought low and you say, lift them up, then he will save the downcast. He will deliver even one who is not innocent, who will be delivered through the cleanness of your hands.
Okay. You see, Eliphaz says the same thing over again, doesn't he? You see his assumption that Job is guilty of sin in verses 1 through 4. He accuses him personally with a list of horrible sins. And they've gotten real frustrated, obviously. You know, Job fears God and shuns evil, right? That's the characterization of Job in chapter 1 and 2. But here they're beginning to falsely accuse him, trying to browbeat him down to accept that he is guilty, that he is wicked.
They make the accusation, they don't offer any specific proof.
Right, yeah. Verse 10 and 11, he explains once again, you know, your problem is your sin. Make sure I get these right now. Y'all can check me. 10 and 11. Okay. Verses 21 through 27, he attempts one final time to give Job advice. Turn to God, accept instruction through the punishment. In other words, Job's punishment is God instructing him. Okay, that's what he says here. He says, if you do that, he will restore you to your former greatness. I think he gets really carried away in verse 28 to 30 here. He says, you know, what you decide on will be done. Boy, don't you wish that was true in life? I can be righteous, so what I decide on will be done, you know. The light will shine on your ways. When men are brought low and you say, lift them up, then he will save the downcast. In other words, God's going to save people because I say so. You know, that's the power of my being righteous. He will deliver even one who is not innocent, who will be delivered through the cleanness of your hands. So, if my hands are clean enough, God will save a sinner.
In that case, they ought to be telling God to relieve Job.
Yeah.
If they're righteous.
That's kind of a proxy relationship there, isn't
it? Yeah, I think that's a gross exaggeration of the benefits of being righteous, you know. Let's see.
There's only one man ever lived that he would that would apply to, and that's Jesus.
Yeah. Verse 27, he says, you will pray and he will hear you and you will fulfill your vow. So he refers to Job's prayer here. Back in chapter 16, Job said, even though I'm going through this, my prayer is still pure. So here's another example of where they bring up his prayer because he brought it up, but they're using it against him, you know. And I noticed too, I didn't have this in my notes, but Eliphaz says in verse 19, the righteous see their ruin and rejoice. The innocent mock them, saying, surely our foes are destroyed and fire devours their wealth. Notice when Job speaks in 24, he says, why doesn't God Almighty not set times for judgment? But they don't see that, you know. So we're going to see him. He's going to be talking about this when we get to him in chapter 24. Verse 18, I like this. Verse 18, Eliphaz says, yet it was he who filled their houses with good things, so I stand aloof from the counsel of the wicked. Job just said that in chapter 21. He said, verse 16, he says, their prosperity is not in their own hands, so I stand aloof from the counsel of the wicked. So they're using the same language, you know, they're using Job's words to condemn Job, you know. So, okay, read Erdman. We'll keep up with Erdman for the sake of completeness.
This is from 22 through 31, the third round. Eliphaz speaks for the third and last time. It is still the same stubborn line of argument. Job is in the wrong. Eliphaz even lists out his sins in verses 5 through 9. Job had thought he could hide the fact from God, verse 14. Let him return to God, put away his sin, and all will be well again.
Okay. Now let's read Job's reply to Eliphaz here in round 3. Let's just read these one at a time, okay? Rather than reading 23 and 24 together, let's read 23, and then we'll read 24. So, anybody want to read 23? Okay.
Then Job replied, even today my complaint is bitter. His hand is heavy in spite of my groaning. If only I knew where to find him, if only I could go to his dwelling. I would state my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I will find out what he would answer me and consider what he would say. Would he oppose me with great power? No, he would not press charges against me. There an upright man would present his case before him, and I would be delivered forever from my judge. But if I go to the east, he is not there. If I go to the west, I do not find him. When he is at work in the north, I do not see him. When he returns to the south, I catch no glimpse of him. But he knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I will come forth as gold. My feet have closely followed his steps. I have kept to his way without turning aside. I have not departed from the commands of his lips. I have treasured the words of his mouth more than my daily bread. But he stands alone, and who can oppose him? He does whatever he pleases. He carries out his decree against me, and many such plans he still has in store. That is why I am terrified before him. When I think of all this, I fear him. God has made my heart faint. The Almighty has terrified me. Yet I am not silenced by the darkness, by the thick darkness that covers my face.
Okay, in this chapter, Job returns to this idea that if he could just state his case to God, he's convinced that he would be vindicated. But he doesn't know where to find God. He doesn't know where to go to get to God. He can't find him. But he does express confidence in himself that he is striven to be righteous. He is treasured up God's word in his mouth. He's tried to live a righteous life. And he expresses confidence in God's ultimate justice. Okay?
Now you said he has tried, he has, you know, but when I was listening to her, I thought it said, I have done this, I have done that.
Right, yeah.
And that's what bugs me a little bit when he talks. Because
he sounds a little self-righteous.
Yeah, maybe,
you're right. That's a good point. And that's the reason I said tried.
Yeah,
but I don't really believe, because he does sound more and more angry and self-righteous, and that's what Elihu accuses him of. And I think that's part of confusion between him and his friends.
Yeah.
But I believe that he has been a righteous man. He has been, you know, he's shunned evil, he's feared God, and he's done all the things that a man can do, being imperfect and being a sinner.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. There are none righteous.
Right.
Okay.
Well,
yeah, God testified that he's, you know, blameless and upright. So
right.
I don't think anybody can argue with that if God says it.
Yeah. And God says refers to him as his servant several times throughout, you know, at the end of the book and at the beginning. So, but he's talking, I don't know whether he's not speaking to God here, but I guess he's speaking to his three friends. You know, he says, I believe I'm innocent. I believe God is just. If I could just find a way to get my case before him, I'm sure he would vindicate me. That's what he says in chapter 23. Do you want to read 23 for us now, or does it mix up with 24?
Then it's mixed up. We have to read 24.
All right, let's read 24. Who wants to read 24 for the class? You want me to read it?
No.
Joan?
Okay. Why does the Almighty not set times for judgment? Why must those who know him look in vain for such days? Men move boundary stones. They passed your flocks, they have stolen. You drive away the orphan's donkey and take the widow's ox in pledge. They thrust the needy from the path and force all the poor of the land into hiding, like wild donkeys in the desert. The poor go about their labor of foraging food. The wasteland provides food for their children. They gather fodder in the fields and glean in the vineyards of the wicked. Lacking clothes, they spend the night naked. They have nothing to cover themselves in the cold. They are drenched by mountain rains and hug the rocks for lack of shelter. The fatherless child is snatched from the breast. The infant of the poor is seized for a debt. Lacking clothes, they go about naked. They carry the sheaves but still go hungry. They crush olives among the terraces. They tread the wine presses, yet suffer thirst. The groans of the dying rise from the city, and the souls of the wounded cry out for help. But God charges no one with wrongdoing. There are those who rebel against the light, who do not know its ways or stay in its path. When daylight is gone, the murderer rises up and kills the poor and needy. In the night, he steals for it like a thief. The eye of the adulterer watches for dust. He thinks, no eye will see me, and he keeps his face concealed. In the dark, men break into houses, but by day they shut themselves in. They want nothing to do with the light. For all of them, deep darkness is their mourning. They make friends with the terrors of darkness. Yet they are foam on the surface of the water. Their portion of the land is cursed, so that no one goes to the vineyards. As heat and drought snatch away the melted snow, so the grave snatches away those who have sinned. The womb forgets them. The worm feasts on them. Evil men are no longer remembered, but are broken like a tree. They prey on the barren and childless woman, and to the widow show no kindness. But God drags away the mighty by his power. Though they become established, they have no assurance of life. He may let them rest in a feeling of security, but his eyes are on their ways. For a little while they are exalted, and then they are gone. They are brought low and gathered up like all others. They are cut off like the heads of grain. If this is not so, who can prove me false and reduce my words to nothing?
Okay. So, you begin the chapter with, why doesn't God set a time for judgment? Why must those who know him, that's the innocent, look in vain for such days? And then he lists here a lot of the things that the wicked do, and they do it. The wicked oppress the righteous. And he said, God does nothing. God charges no one with wrongdoing, you know. And he's talking about the widows and the orphans are are oppressed by the wicked, and God doesn't do anything about it. So in chapter 21, he refuted this. In this chapter, he refutes this. The righteous do suffer, and they suffer sometimes at the hand of the wicked. Okay? So that's Job's refutation of this and this in their theology. But he gets, it's getting a little confusing, you know, because in one chapter he says, in the first of this, he talks about how the wicked are so wicked, and back in 21, he says, nobody denounces them to their face, and then in the latter part of this chapter, he seems to imply, starts to kind of sound like Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar, the wicked do suffer. They get their just deserts sometimes. So the only way I can explain it is we're reading poetry here, and sometimes it's a sometimes, you know, sometimes yes, sometimes no, is Job's position. The wicked do get their just deserts, but they get away with a lot when it comes to their oppression of the righteous, and God doesn't do anything about it. So he says, this is reality. What you got up here, your theology is garbage. But this is the way life really is.
Okay? We're confused. We can't tell.
Yeah.
We can't tell what God's doing because it happens to everybody.
Yeah, and I think that's the key. Mm-hmm. Is, and then we're going to get to that, hopefully, if not today, first thing next week. What is the key to... Our wisdom doesn't mean we understand God. You know, we wisdom doesn't give us the gift of explaining what God's doing and why. And we'll talk about that next week. But in 21, he refutes this. In chapter 24, he refutes this. And he talks in 13 through 17 about how the wicked love darkness. And I thought about, you know, that's in John's writings. That's in the Psalms and the Proverbs about the wicked, the adulterer sneaking around at night, thinking he's getting away with something.
He won't come into the light.
Yeah. So you see that. What do you call that, Janice? Symbolic, figurative description of the wickedness of man?
Then they even say, when it gets dark, it's like their morning.
Yeah, that's when they come out, right? That's when they get up and go to work, when it gets dark at night.
Yeah, well, there are many things being written in which darkness and light are the contrasting themes, and that the story is developed from there.
There's no doubt. There's all kinds of things happen at night that are illegal that no one would ever try to do in the daytime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Peter, and it says that they get drunk at night.
Yeah,
people get drunk at night, and they do this and that in the darkness.
Yeah, my daddy used to get home before midnight, because that's when all the drunks are going home. You get killed if you're out at that time of night.
I guess that's why my mama said nothing good goes on after 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
You ought to be in the house.
Okay, did we read Erdman?
No.
Okay, let's read Erdman.
This is Job's reply in 23 and 24. If only he could find God and put his case to him. But God is not to be found, and his ways are inexplicable. Chapter 24, look at what goes on in the world. Life is neither fair nor just. God delays judgment, and those who trample the helpless underfoot seem to get away with it. And then he gives two examples, like removing landmarks and boundary stones to seize lands. The landmark was a stone sometimes inscribed with a landowner's title deeds and boundaries. And then in 24, 3 and 9, take in pledge, take as security for credit, or seize in payment for debt.
Okay. So, the debate is over, okay, at this point, because Bildad speaks in chapter 25 and he doesn't really say anything. He doesn't, and all he says is God is great, God is powerful, and man is a worm and a maggot. That's all he says.
And he's inexplicable. He really shows that many times. Can't explain.
I'll read 25 here. Then Bildad the Shuhite replied, "Dominion and all belong to God. He establishes order in the heights of heaven. Can his forces be numbered? Upon whom does his light not rise? How then can a man be righteous before God? How can one born of woman be pure? If even the moon is not bright and the stars are not pure in his eyes, how much less man who is but a maggot, the son of man who is only a worm? And that's all Bildad says, and Zophar doesn't speak at all. So the debate is over at this point. And Job has, and when we get to Elihu says, you guys continued to condemn Job, but you couldn't prove him wrong. That's what Elihu says when we get there. So, read what he says about chapter 25.
Okay. Bildad speaks for the third and last time. If the speech is complete as it stands, Job's friends have exhausted their argument. They have nothing more to say. Bildad merely reiterates the obvious truth that no man is 100% perfect in God's sight. This does not help Job. What point is there in godly living if God's punishment falls equally on good and bad?
Okay, so we got about 10 minutes. I would like to get us through chapter 27 if I can. So I'm gonna read 26 here. He says, "How you have," this is Job's reply to Bildad, "how you have helped the powerless, how you have saved the arm that is feeble. What advice you have offered to one without wisdom, and what great insights you've displayed. Who has helped you utter these words? Whose spirit spoke from your mouth? The dead are in deep anguish, those beneath the waters and all that live in them. Death is naked before God. Destruction lies uncovered. He spreads out the northern skies over empty space. He suspends the earth over nothing. He wraps up the waters in his clouds, yet the clouds do not burst under their weight. He covers the face of the full moon, spreading his clouds over it. He marks out the horizon from the face of the waters for a boundary between light and darkness. The pillars of the heavens quake aghast at his rebuke. By his power, he churned up the sea. By his wisdom, he cut Rahab to pieces. By his breath, the skies became fair. His hand pierced the gliding serpent. Those are but the outer fringe of his works. How faint the whisper we hear of him. Who then can understand the thunder of his power?" So in this chapter, all Job is doing is extolling the mighty deeds of God, right? Of course, he's real sarcastic to his friends about their wisdom and their advice to him. But in this chapter, let's see.
It's all those things Platt talked about. He shows his power, his authority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like verse 8 and 9. That impresses me that Job knows. He says, God puts water in the clouds, and yet the clouds don't burst under their weight. You know, how in the world would Job... I did this calculation one time. I'm a junior mathematician, okay? But if you take... It rains 1 inch over the southeast. Take the area of the southeast times 1 inch depth and compute the volume of that water. And it is staggering. It is amazing how much water God evaporates out of the Gulf and blows up, you know, the tornado out of here and dumps all that. He's got an irrigation system that's just amazing to me. But all that water is in the air, but it doesn't come out until it's time to rain, you know. And that's always amazed me. It's just something to think about, you know. Some of the wonders of God, the way he's done things. I like the end of the chapter. He says, all these things God has done, but this is just a whisper, just a faint, feeble amount of, we can't comprehend all the things that he's done. Did we read 26? Dennis? Did we read 26?
You heard my
name. No, I don't think
it
goes through 31.
All right, well, so let's, yeah. Well, I think you can just read this.
Oh, okay.
The 26th.
Okay, chapter 26. It does have two sentences, one sentence. Now, in the created universe, we catch a glimpse of God's dynamic power. But who can think to comprehend what power in all of it, that power in all of its fullness?
Okay, so now we come to 27. Somebody read the first 11, no, first 10 verses of 27.
Okay. Job continues his discourse, as surely as God lives, who has denied me justice? And the Almighty who has made my life bitter, as long as I have life within me, the breath of God in my nostrils, my lips will not say anything wicked, and my tongue will not utter lies. I will never admit you are in the right. Till I die, I will not deny my integrity. I will maintain my innocence and never let it go. My conscience will not reproach me as long as I live. May my enemy be like the wicked, my adversary like the unjust. For what hope have the godless when they are cut off? When God takes away their life, does God listen to their cry when distress comes upon them? Will they find the light in the Almighty? Will they call on God at all times?
Okay, so he says emphatically, I'll never agree with you guys. I'll never give up my integrity. I'll never give up my righteous ways of living. So he's very emphatic that he totally disagrees with his three friends. Now, somebody read the rest of the chapter, 11 through 23. You want me to read it? Okay. Go ahead. Who said that? Go ahead, John.
I will teach you about the power of God. The ways of the Almighty I will not conceal. You have all seen this yourselves. Why then this meaningless talk? Here is the fate God allots to the wicked. The heritage a ruthless man receives from the Almighty. However, many his children, their fate is the sword. His offspring will never have enough to eat. The plague will bury those who survive him, and their widows will not weep for them. Though he heaps up silver like dust, and clothes like piles of clay, what he lays up the righteous will wear, and the innocent will divide his silver. The house he builds is like a moth's cocoon, like a hut made by a watchman. He lies down wealthy, but will do so no more. When he opens his eyes, all is gone. Terrors overtake him like a flood. A tempest snatches him away in the night. The east wind carries him off, and he is gone. It sweeps him out of his place. It hurls itself against him without mercy, as he flees headlong from his power. It claps his hand in derision and hisses him out of his place.
Okay, you see the problem? You see a problem here? He says, I'll never agree with you guys, and then he sounds exactly like what they've been saying. And so a lot of the commentary, Herdman included, says maybe there's a textual error here. Okay? Maybe this is Zophar's third speech. Okay, I don't like that explanation myself. I don't think I have a very good explanation, but I don't like that one because there's bad implications to stating there's a textual error in the scripture. Okay, so I don't like what a lot of commentaries say, that maybe this is Zophar speaking here and not Job, because it sounds so much like what they've been saying.
If I was Job at this point, I'd be hysterical.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the explanations. Those who, like me, that don't admit to a textual error say, well, maybe Job is just delusional and confused and his suffering is so great.
Maybe he's not even talking to them. He's just talking, speaking out of, this is what they say.
Yeah.
If I will teach you about the power of God, that sounds like one of them, not at all like Job.
Yeah.
So far, he's been mystified about the power of God.
Yeah.
Somewhat.
I said he sound, so one argument is maybe he's confused, he's delusional because of his suffering. He sure don't sound the confused before and after this. He's very lucid and very very clear in his thinking. So I don't like that explanation.
It's very clear, really, the first six verses.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to deny my integrity.
Yeah. The other explanation is maybe he's mocking his friends to show them how stupid they sound. You know? But he doesn't say that anywhere, that he's mocking them. So
maybe he just got frustrated and lost it for a minute.
Yeah. I think it's more like they just didn't label that speech.
Well, so you would agree that it's possible that it's a textual error.
I think I'm reading it. I'm not studying it like that.
Well, I don't know. I don't like the textual error explanation, but it's the most. It fits the facts the best. Erdman says either he's rethinking, he's changing the way he's thinking, or it's a textual error. Well, I don't think he's changed the way he's thinking. If you keep going, he doesn't change anything.
Read
what Erdman says.
On 27, his friends want him to deny his integrity, but Job will not perjure himself. Verses 7 to 23 sound strange coming from Job. This has previously been the argument his friends have put forward. Either Job's thinking has changed, or this passage really belongs to one of the others, perhaps Zophar's missing third speech.
Okay, so that's Erdman's explanation. Either he's changed his mind, or it's a textual error. It could be Bildad's, the end of Bildad's third speech, and Zophar didn't speak at all, because Bildad's third speech is about that long, you know. But this is a clue to me. He says, talking about the wicked, he says, may my enemies, in verse 7, be like the wicked, my adversaries like the unjust. For what hope has the godless when he's cut off? You know, we talked about last week, Job said, the wicked don't have any hope that endures beyond the grave. So they don't have any hope. That's going to save. And then he says, does God listen to their cry when distress comes upon him? Will the wicked find delight in the Almighty? Will he call upon God at all times? In other words, when God causes the wicked to suffer, he doesn't have anywhere to go, right? So maybe he's just reaffirming here his confidence that God ultimately is just, that the wicked will eventually be punished, you know. But I don't like that too much either, you know, because he sounds so much like his friends. So.
Well, they're his friends for some reason.
Yeah. And we have to remember, too, that none of them are right. You remember what David Platt said? They're all got stuff wrong in what they're saying. So Job doesn't have to be perfectly right all the time. But anyway,
friendship is that way. People in Congress can get along until they get down to what's going on, like right now.
Yeah.
All this division, they're at each other's throats.
Okay, so here's my summary. The debate is over. Maybe I've overanalyzed the poem. But I try to do two things. One is to completely understand Job's position in the debate. And two is to find a rational reason for Job to say what he says in chapter 27. Without resorting to accepting a textual error. I believe there are bad implications anytime you assume a textual error in the scripture. It's occurred to me, if that's a textual error, it's been there for thousands of years and biblical scholars haven't seen fit to correct it. And so that kind of flies in the face of what a lot of people say about how readily scribes changed the text when they couldn't explain it, you know, or they wanted to have another theology. But I don't have a perfect explanation for the last part of 27, and I invite you to think about it and meditate on it. And if
you can come up with a better answer, let me know what it is, because I'm very curious to know. And we're going to stop there. We'll start with chapter 28 next week. We're through with the debate. There's this poem on wisdom in chapter 28, and then Job's got some vows that he's going to make, and he's going to sound very self-righteous, like Sandra said. And then we're going to get to Elihu and God, and we'll be through with the book. Okay? So I appreciate it.